Well, as Dave mentioned earlier at the beginning, our speaker this morning is, what's his name? Andy Giesman, that's right. And he was actually here back in September. Some of you might have remembered that. So he was willing to come and step in and speak for a couple weeks and with a series that he's going to do. He grew up in the area, actually went to Ross Corners School. I think it was before Kathy started teaching, so that's way back. No, I don't know how long. But the Lord has led him many years through various ways, and he is now, for the past 5 years, been an adjunct professor at Marywood College and University of Scranton. And so he rubs shoulders with college students quite often, and he developed and is the executive director of the Addison's Walk Institute. That just means he's in charge of it. And if you want to know more about that, he has a table to talk about that. He might may say a few words about that. But we're glad to have him come and speak, and he's going to talk about Daniel. He'll talk more about that. But Andy, come on up. We're glad that you're here. And Lord, thanks for coming.
You're welcome. Well, good morning, church. I really don't know how to adjust this. Matt, we'll just go with that. Feels a little tall, but that's okay. We'll make it work. No, we got to put it down. This thing? I like you guys. In seriousness, though, I really enjoy worshiping with you. The sound is fantastic. I love hearing harmony. That's good. It's just wonderful. So I'm very happy to be back sharing with you. You need to think of the next three, today and the next two Sundays together, the 3 weeks I'm going to be with you as one giant sermon. We're going to be covering 4 points in those three sermons. I am conditioned to speak in 90-minute time slots, so it's not like scary to me. I know you're like, oh no, what is happening? And for those of you who are visiting, you're so scared right now. I hope I'm not going to freak you out too badly. But we are going to be looking at the contemporary university through the lens of Daniel 1 and chapter 2, the first half of chapter 2. We're going to use those as springboards. We're going to be going elsewhere in the book of Daniel as well to try to help us make some points and to understand some things. And we're also going to be looking at this lens, this issue of the modern university, and we're going to be looking at literature, history, and philosophy, besides Bible and theology. I sit at the crossroads of all those things, so I'm kind of an uber nerd with that stuff, and you can't stop me. So we're going to do that. And as we begin this morning, I want to introduce you to a very recent archaeological discovery. You probably have not seen this. In fact, I'm sure this is so recent, none of you have seen it. If any of you have an archaeology study Bible, I was at a church in Wisconsin just a few days ago. I am in New York now, right? Okay, I'm a little confused as to where I am. The pastor of that church had a brand new archaeology study Bible just still in the plastic, and I said, I guarantee you haven't seen this either. But this is one of those amazing things. I want to share it with you. It is a letter dated April 2nd, 605 BC. Here's what it says. The great king, Nebuchadnezzar, may Marduk protect him, and the Office of Vassal State and Missions wish to extend to you a formal invitation to be part of the class of 602 BC at the University of Babylon. Why are you laughing? This is serious archaeology. I'm delighted to offer my sincere congratulations for such an esteemed honor. As you are well aware, the University of Babylon, King's College, is the most prestigious institution of higher education in the world. You'll be learning alongside other young men of your age in the most technologically advanced city the world has ever seen. We are holding a spot for you in the Hammurabi School of Mesopotamian Religion and Wizardry. Many of our graduates are given the honor of serving His Majesty at the conclusion of their 3-year accelerated program. You will soon be receiving a cuneiform tablet via Empire Express, which will give you details for welcome weekend. You should plan to arrive at the Ishtar Gate. Sincerely, Ashpenaz, Dean of Students. P.S. I shouldn't be telling you this, but you might want to check with Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. They might have received similar letters. All right, clearly I made that up. Now you don't trust me for the next 3 weeks. And it is a stretch, but I did take a seminary class in sermon stretching, so I've studied that at the graduate level. And there was no official University of Babylon in 605 BC. There was not. Yet we have four young men, Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, better known as the last three. Or if you watch VeggieTales, Rack, Shack, and Benny. Thank you. Right? Can I drink this? Is this fresh?
No.
Nope. I would have just drank it. All right. So we have these four young men who scholars, many of whom believe were probably teenagers. I hold to that. I'm not going to die on that hill. Probably about 15 years of age, taken from their home, shuttled nearly 1,000 miles from modern-day Israel to modern-day Iraq. Taken from their homes, and they were taught, and they learned. And what we're going to do is we're going to explore four fundamental worldview questions that every college student must answer, and you and I must as well. And I'm going to explain what that means as we continue going this morning. And as Tim told you just a few minutes ago, I do have a ministry to college students in Scranton. Effectively, I'm a missionary to college students. That's just the easy way of describing what I do. My in is through the classroom. I teach philosophy and theology at Marywood University and the University of Scranton. I've had over 1,000 students come through my classroom in those 5 years. And I am genetically incapable of giving multi-part exams. Thank you, Ryan. Oh, you opened it for me. Yep. Taste fresh. That's the water. Nothing like it. Right. So I'm incapable of giving multi-part, multi-question exams because in a humanities class like religion, theology, we would call it, or philosophy, I don't think you're demonstrating that you learn anything by merely memorizing scads of information and regurgitating it onto a paper. Now, I was a guy in college. Those were the classes I tried to take. I avoided writing papers for that very reason. Well, now I am that guy. So I make them write papers because I want them to be forced to synthesize and crystallize ideas and make arguments for things and actually take a position on something, which for the average 19-year-old is the cardinal sin. To actually say, this is what I think to be correct. They love to say, this is what I feel, and I respond to, I don't care. I don't care how you feel. I want you to tell me what you think. And why do you think it is true? And in so doing, I think it is a good exercise for them, whether they dislike it or me for that. It is indeed a good exercise, but it's also really beneficial for me as I attempt to better understand my mission field, which means that I need to know what my students are thinking. And not necessarily what they're thinking, but how they are thinking. It's called thought language. I spoke to you about this back in September. And so I want to just run through just a few quotes that are actual quotes from student papers. So in a philosophy class, the very first thing they have to do, first week, I have them write a 1 to 2 page critical reflection paper answering the question, is studying philosophy valuable, yes or no? If it's a religion class, I ask them the same question only about theology, or if it's in particular a Bible class, should we study the Bible in the 21st century, yes or no? And I do my best in those first couple days to convince them that they're free to disagree with me. In fact, I invite dissent. I want it. Because the university classroom is one of two places on the planet that honest questions should be met with honest answers. You do know where the other place is, right? Okay. So, Some of them actually believe me, and they actually write from the heart, and sometimes the mind, and tell me what they think, and I want to share some of those things with you. So these are actual quotes from papers. First of all, we must have evil in order to know good. We must have evil in order to know good. I picked up in the announcements, I do not know the Rittenberg family, but I assume something not good is happening there. Disease, perhaps. I'm not sure. I don't know. My students would argue that that is absolutely necessary in order for people to know what is good. Just think about it. How would you answer that question? What that assumes is that evil is metaphysically necessary. What does that mean? It means that it exists by itself alongside of other things like love, mercy, justice, forgiveness, grace. If you want a full explanation on why evil cannot exist by itself, but it is a parasite, you'll just have to have me back sometime, and I'll gladly talk about it. This is one of my favorites. It usually shows up in an ethics class, which is ironic. There is no right or wrong belief system. It's fascinating. A student will be writing a paper arguing for or against one particular ethical system, and ethics is just a way of saying, how do I know the difference between right and wrong, and what is the right thing to do, and when should I do it? These are all questions that ethics answers. And it's amazing to me the number of times students will either begin or end a paper, sometimes bookend the whole thing with a statement like this, and then in the middle argue that there is no true right or wrong. Or argue for whatever they're arguing for or against, that there's right or wrong. Now, if I were being a real smarty pants, I would just give them an F, because there is no system. That applies to me, does it not? I haven't had the guts to do that yet, but someday I will be ornery enough, and it will happen. I'll let you know how that goes. Faith is basically a strong feeling. You see, the students to whom you minister, and I love the fact that a major state university is measured in distance of yards from the front door of this building, not miles. You have an amazing opportunity. You know that. I'm just affirming what you know. I'm jealous, by the way. The students that you have, and many of you in this room, have been reared on the theology of Disney, Pixar, DreamWorks, and Sony Animation. There's theology in those films? Oh, yes. You know what it tells you? If you believe something strongly enough, if you conjure up a deep feeling of faith inside of you, then whatever it is that you attach that faith to becomes reality. What a lie from the pit of hell. It's not a strong feeling. In fact, Hebrews 11, the great classic passage on what is faith. Faith is the substance of things hoped for, the evidence of things not seen. The unnamed author of that glorious book tells us that faith is both it is both substantive and evidentiary. It has weight. It has mass. And lastly, if science cannot answer the question is not worth asking. Now, I want to share a little illustration of who wrote this. The other three are really ubiquitous. I couldn't tell you one particular student they're attached to. I see it all the time. This fourth one I will never forget. A student in my Theology 2 class at the University of Scranton, which the subtitle is Basic Christian Doctrines, and I get to do pretty much whatever I want with that class, which is pretty amazing. So I had a student whom I shall call Rachel. That is not her real name. And she wrote that in that very first paper. Now, Rachel sat up front to my right. She was the kind of student that would kind of just look at her split ends, you know, twirling them in her fingers the whole time. She was kind to me. She was polite. She was respectful, as almost every student I've had is. Didn't seem particularly engaged or interested. But showed up, she was there every day and did her work, and she was doing fine in the class. A few days before Thanksgiving break of the fall semester of that year, she came to me. And she said, Andy, I would just like to know, would it be okay if I go home just a few days early for Thanksgiving because I need to go home. And I attach a bit of a grade to their attendance, not hard and fast, but it behooves them to be there. So she wants to know, is it okay if I miss? And I said, yeah, well, what's going on? She said, well, my mom is sick. And all my siblings are going to be home. And so we're just planning on spending some extra time with her, if that's okay. And I said, well, is it serious? She said, well, she has cancer. You know, like, yeah, I have a cold. You know, same kind of thing. And there are ups and downs, and she's just in a we would say, a valley right now. That would be the language we would use. And I said, are you sure this isn't, like, a really big deal? No, it's fine. The Monday after Thanksgiving break, that following Monday, I received an email from the dean's office telling me that Rachel's mom passed away. Now, I don't know to this day. I don't know if she didn't know. I suspect she did, and she was emotionally trying to insulate herself and protect me at the same time. She didn't want to foist her dilemma upon her, you know, middle-aged professor with a, you know, weak heart and a bad constitution or whatever. So I immediately emailed her and said, hey, wow, I'm so sorry. Please let me know. What can I do? I'm praying for you and your family. Do not rush back. Take all the time that you need. And I will work with you on any assignments that come due during that time. Don't sweat it. She came back to school way fast. I was a little surprised. And I had an opportunity eventually to sit down and talk with her. My students don't realize it, but I shepherd them. I do not hold the office of pastor, but I do shepherd my students, particularly when they give me the chance to. So I sat down with her, and I didn't pull out her paper and beat her over the head with it, of course. But I begged God for wisdom, and I pulled together all the years that I've been involved with college or youth ministry, my entire adult life, 20-some years. And I had to come back to this question, and I asked her, in as gentle way it's possible, do you still hold this to be true? Science cannot answer the question is not worth asking. And I'm sad to tell you, this doesn't have a happy ending. She said, yeah, I still hold to that. Had my luggage made at home on Friday. I would have my a book with me today, and I would read you a quote. It's from a book called Faith Versus Reason by Jerry Coyne, C-O-Y-N-E. Jerry Coyne, C-O-Y-N-E, Faith Versus Reason. And in the opening paragraphs of that book, he levels both barrels at organized religion, particularly Christianity, trying to tell you that you're an idiot if you're a person who believes in anything beyond the evidence of science. You say, well, I know that's in our universities. Oh, yes, and it's all around us. It is not just there. So, we are getting to the text today, I promise you, but we'd have to do a few other things first. First of all, I want us to rethink our approach to Daniel. By a show of hands, we're going to interact. Is that okay? Am I allowed to do that? Again, you can't stop me. You can say I can't come back next week, but you can't stop me right now. How many of you, by show of hands, have ever heard a Sunday school lesson, a VBS story, a youth group devotional, or an exegetical message on any part of Daniel? Ah! How many of you have ever let the words escape your mouth, dare to be a? Yeah. Without a show of hands, how many of you actually knew the Hebrew names of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego? Don't raise your hand. Right? Because it's so familiar and probably overly familiar, is it not? Daniel's one of those books that provides really good VBS material. You know, much like Ephesians 6, you know, here's a very serious passage on spiritual warfare. All right, we're going to dress kids up in tinfoil armor, let them whack away at each other with pool noodles and stuff. Woohoo! Right? So Daniel's the same kind of thing. All right, we're going to eat salad every day for VBS, you know. And we're going to build a sandbox and put kittens in it. Ooh, look, Daniel. You're like, the lions are getting you. Right? So we do that with Daniel, and we're very familiar with it, are we not? And is over-familiarity with any part of the Bible a bad idea? No. No, it is not. But we have to be reminded of a couple things. First of all, we generally sanitize the biblical stories that we are overly familiar with. And what I mean by that is we lose the shock and awe. How many of us ceased being amazed, however many years ago, upon hearing the gospel? Well, yeah, I know that. Yeah, you should be amazed by that to this day. Should you not? Right? So we have to work hard at doing that. So I want us, as we build a bridge of culture and time, as we take a field trip that takes us back several millennia, I want us to try to reestablish the shock and awe of what we are reading and try to see this through the perspective of these young men. You willing to do that? Great. Another thing is that we tend to approach stories that we have a lot of familiarity with assumed exegesis. Now, assumed exegesis means that when someone like me says, turn in your Bibles to Daniel 1, and if you're not there, go ahead and turn there. When I say that, you say, oh, I know this already. Right? Again, please don't misunderstand me. Over-familiarity is not a bad thing with any part of God's Word. But what happens is that we think we know all that there is to know there already, and we just kind of we blaze over two sections. We blaze over the stuff that we know, or we blaze over the stuff that we assume is a little too hard, and we get to the things that interest us, and we kind of skip over stuff. Now, it would not surprise me if there are some or many in this room when I said that we have to be warned of an assumed exegesis, which just means to exegete something means to dig out. Think excavate, right? To dig out. Now, it wouldn't surprise me if there are people in this room that would say, I'm not guilty of that. I would never do that. I said the same thing. I am a survivor, graduate of Ross Corners Christian Academy. I went to Ross Corners Baptist Church my whole life. I went off to Bible college. I have 3 degrees from Clark Summit University. And when I was first told that I might be doing this, I thought, nah. And I really got slapped upside the head when I began my MA in philosophy, which was a great books-based program. And my professor at Clark Summit University, Steve Shoemaker, when I was looking at the very first thing I had to read, discuss, dissect, talk about, was Homer's Iliad. Now, I know enough to know that that's a story about Achilles. That's all I know. And that it's written by an old dead dude. That's all I knew. Greek literature, all I knew. And so I was talking to Steve, and I said, hey, is there like a primer? Is there Sparks Notes? Should I read the translator's introduction in the English translation I have? He said, no. Why? Just begin with the first word, because you will find yourself asking exegetical questions. Let's try a little experiment. Here's the opening lines of Homer's Iliad. Rage, goddess. Sing the rage of Peleus' son Achilles, murderous, doomed, that cost the Achaeans countless losses, hurling down to the house of death so many sturdy souls, great fighter souls, but made their bodies carry on, feasts for the dogs and birds, and the will of Zeus was moving towards its end. Begin, Muse, when the two first broke and clashed, Agamemnon, lord of men, and brilliant Achilles. What in the world? Right? Do you have some questions? Who's Peleus? Who's the goddess? I kind of know who Achilles is, but why is he so cheesed off? Why is he fighting with Agamemnon? What makes him a great warrior? Who is he fighting? Why is he fighting? You could fill a sheet of paper with your questions just on the opening lines of a very long poem. Do you know what kinds of questions those are? Exegetical questions. So, just as an exercise, it's good to read stuff you have no familiarity with just to help you understand, oh, there are things I need to ask. Right? Okay. And then we got just 2 more. We need to be careful that we do not mythologize characters in space-time. So if the first obstacle that we just need to be aware of losing the shock and awe, we also need not think of these boys and this story as just a myth. That we can get some what is the moral of the story? Well, there is indeed a point to the story, but we need to remember that these people existed in space and time. They are of flesh and blood and spirit, just like you and I. This really happened. Lastly, as a reminder, we must understand that the Bible is not just history, it is theological history. History, if accurate, and the best way to study history is from primary sources, as close as you can get to an eyewitness of the accounts that you are reading about, tells you what happened. Does the Bible tell us what happened? Yes. But theological history takes it a significant step up. It doesn't just tell us what happened, it tells us why. So we're going to be looking at the why. Now, back to that phrase, dare to be a Daniel. How many, again, we're going to go back to a little bit of participation. How many of you would say, you know, I've had at least one adult say that to me at some point in my life, dare to be Daniel, or I've said it to someone else? Come on. I want you to think about what a serious challenge that is. You see, when our students go off to college, whether it be the strictest, most conservative Bible college on the planet, or what we would consider a safe Christian liberal arts college, or a college that calls itself Christian or is not, a state university that you have over across the street, or a private, pretty much secular university like where I teach, we often have a goal for our students, and the goal is this. We just want them to go there, and we want them to maintain their faith in God. May I suggest to you that if that's our goal, we are aiming far too low. And the amazing thing about Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah is not the fact that they maintained a private faith in God. You can maintain a private faith in anything. You can maintain a secret belief in anything you like as long as you keep your mouth shut. Because belief is a basic human freedom that can never be taken from you. You may be forced to sign the document, to disavow what you say you really believe in your heart, and those are serious things, but no one can ever really take away your belief. It is a basic human freedom. These boys could have maintained their belief in Yahweh, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, the covenant-keeping God, whom we are introduced to and learn a great deal of in the stories and the pages leading up to the time of Daniel in 605 B.C. They could have said, we will maintain who we are as Hebrews and we will do all the things we need to do to survive. If they had done that, this second part never would have happened. The amazing thing is that they maintained a high-profile public witness for God in a hostile environment. The amazing thing is not that these boys maintained a private faith in God by keeping their mouth shut, keeping their heads down, their eyes lowered. They maintained a high-profile public witness for God in a hostile environment over and over and over, risking their very lives for what they believed deep down in their heart gave them a good feeling. No, for what they knew to be true. I am not suggesting that we never say, dare to be a Daniel ever again, but if you do, let us remember one thing. Protest in the name of God will be to your physical and intellectual disadvantage. There may come a day when we are no longer protected, whether it be fiscally, tax-free status, and all that kind of stuff. I have a friend who is the chair of philosophy at Western Michigan University, a grand Christian man, one of my heroes. And he has said to me recently, he said, Andy, I think there may be coming a day, maybe we won't see it in our lifetime, and I pray that we do not, but it could happen, where Christianity, we are no longer called to defend the truth of Christianity, but we will be called to defend its goodness. That has happened before. in history, it would not be the first time. So what do you hold on to? All right, let's get into the text, and we're going to cover a whopping two verses today. Daniel chapter 1, verse 1. In the third year of the reign of Jehoiakim, king of Judah, Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, came to Jerusalem and besieged it. Is that history or theological history? Not a trick question. What would you call it? I would call it history, right? And the Lord delivered Jehoiakim, king of Judah, into his hand, along with some of the articles from the temple of God. These he carried off to the temple of his God in Babylonia and put them in the treasure house of his God. History or theological history? Theological history. Theological history. Here it is, the opening words of verse 2. And the Lord delivered Jehoiakim into the hand of Nebuchadnezzar. We are going to be looking at four fundamental worldview questions. And the first is this. Who or what is behind human history? Who or what is behind human history? And again, if I may make an assumption, and I think I'm right about this, it would not surprise me if most, if not everyone in this room would say, well, I know the answer to that. It is God. Good. I agree with you. I happen to agree with you there. But what does that mean and why does it matter? Well, part of the reason of why that matters is because wrapped up in that question is then, what is my story? Who or what is behind my purpose? Where does my value come from? In the papers that my students write, I see three questions come up over and over and over again, and for some of my students, it literally keeps them awake at night. They ask, where did I come from? Questions of origin. What is my purpose? What am I supposed to do? And then a question of where am I going? What is my destiny? What happens when it's all over? And those three are very much wrapped up together. And so we're going to be looking at the second one, the second question of those three, who or what is behind human history? Now, let's talk about what I mean by fundamental worldview questions. Let's just talk about that so we're all on the same page. There are basically nine in my summation, and I'm not going to die on this hill either. You can have a different number if you like. There are nine fundamental questions that every human being has to deal with either consciously or subconsciously. And usually it's in times of crisis that you actually deal with them consciously. Like one of those questions is, what happens at death? Well, usually if you're facing your own mortality, or a friend or a loved one has passed away or is going to, that's the time you ask that question, right? Okay, so the nine fundamental worldview questions, and I'm not going to tell you all nine of them, we're only dealing with four, cannot be broken down any further than they are. So, for instance, that question, what happens at death? There are, once you ask the question, then there are different branches that you can discuss with it. So your answer could be nothing, right? Well, you're done. So if that's your answer, then there's nothing more to discuss, nothing. Or something, well, what is that something? Do you cross over? And if so, to where? And how do you get there? And what is it? Or is it something like, well, I don't think you cross over anywhere, but I think you kind of cycle back and go through stuff all over again. These are all different ways to answer the one fundamental question. So for those of you who are science-y people in the room, think elemental. You can't get any more basic than the element, right? I wear an element on the ring finger of my left hand. It is tungsten, also known as wolfram, my favorite element, because it's got the word wolf in it. It's got like some nerdy, like Lord of the Rings kind of looking thing on it. But something that is a fundamental question, you cannot ask any more basic. It is the baseline, right? Worldview, what does that mean? The worldview is the grid through which every person on the planet processes reality. A worldview is the grid that every person on the planet uses to process reality. You can think about it as lenses, as glasses. So I do not wear these to kind of, you know, hype up my professor vibe. Although I get accused of trying hard, okay, fine. I do want to look the part. But I really need these to see. In fact, if I did not know I was at Grace Point Church in Vestal, I would have no idea where I am. Taking these off. And by the way, you're all several degrees more attractive right now. So my optometrist tells me that these lenses correct my vision. And they do so pretty well. There's a reason I wear glasses instead of contacts, because I have some other things going on, because it corrects my vision better than contacts. A worldview does not necessarily correct your vision. The question is, what are the lenses through which you're viewing reality? But those lenses are the basic filter that you use to process information. So if you are the kind of person who gets up and you either log on to Facebook or your favorite news site and you're seeing what happened overnight, right? So in news in the entertainment world, Anthony Bourdain took his life, right? And so if you're a fan of his show, what was it? Parts Unknown, thank you. Parts Unknown. As you hear that news, you process the reality of that through your worldview. So whether it be primarily a Christian worldview, well, that's going to be part of the process. If it's not, well, there's going to be other processes. So everybody does that. And so Daniel is telling us up front how he's processing this information. So here's the deal with Jerusalem and Babylon. The fact that Babylon lays siege to Jerusalem and takes tributes, captives back to Babylon, is not really that big of a deal. Jerusalem is kind of a smallish city as compared to Babylon, which is the greatest, biggest, baddest group of people on the planet. Technologically advanced in the ways that Daniel and his friends had never seen before. In Babylon, we had one of the wonders of the ancient world, the Hanging Gardens. They didn't have that in Jerusalem, right? It would be like, it wouldn't surprise me if there's somebody in this room who hails from Apalachin, New York. All right, so if, say, New York City got it in their mind that they were going to come lay siege to Apalachin and take what they wanted, you may stone-heartedly say, "Nay, we shall stop you at the gates." Okay, good luck with that. You're not going to stop them, are you? No. And so it's not that big of a deal, but Daniel says, but no, it's not just that, it is God. Now, as we just let that sink for a minute, I want to walk you through a brief history of Babylon. And I want you to remember, just try to keep this in your mind, because I'm going to ask you about this again. And I just want you to ask, I want you to make try to make a simple observation about this stuff. So I'm going to blaze through this. If you're going to attempt to take notes, God bless you. The PowerPoint is available to you. If somebody in the church office here wants to send it to you, you're welcome to it. So the history of Babylon begins with Hammurabi. Look at that beard, you know, hashtag beard goals. Look at that guy, right? That's amazing. I can only imagine. Babylon comes from the Akkadian gates of the gods. As we will discuss later on, I think next week or the week after, I can't remember, we will discover that indeed Babylon is the most technologically advanced city on the planet. It is also the most idolatrous city on the planet. They're extremely religious, much like the Athens Paul discovered in Acts chapter 17. There are really no atheists in Babylon. Nebuchadnezzar built the city walls and temples, and he instituted several political initiatives. Some of you, if you've ever taken a Western civilization class, may have been subjected to reading and writing reports on the Code of Hammurabi, right, which is still referenced to this day. Any discussion of political philosophy would be incomplete without Hammurabi. And after he did that, he really consolidated power in 1755 B.C. Isn't it amazing that we have an accurate record of history that is this old? Mainly because the Akkadian, Mesopotamian, Babylonian, Persian, Assyrian record that they left for us was imprinted into clay tablets, which survived very nicely in that arid environment. They're writing on college-ruled paper. We never would have had it. stone lasts much better. All right. So then let's move up in time to the Hittites and the Assyrians. All right, Sennacherib, good guy or bad guy? He's a bad guy. He's a really bad guy. The Hittites sacked the city in 1595, followed by a group called the Kassites. And Sennacherib destroyed the city in 689 B.C. This is the same Sennacherib of 2 Kings 18 and 19 and Isaiah chapter 37, a parallel story. Also, we're going to come back to the city of Lachish here in a second. Just to remind you in time what is happening, the northern kingdom of Israel, also known as Samaria or Israel, fell to the Assyrians in 721 B.C., never to be heard from again. They, after Solomon's reign and the civil war and the kingdom split, they had no good kings. They didn't last as long as the southern kingdom, which was destroyed by Babylon in 586 B.C., about 20 years after Daniel gets there. So Sennacherib destroyed the city. Now, just to let you know, I just find this fascinating. Sennacherib, as he destroys the city, as we're told the story in 2 Kings 18 and 19 and Isaiah chapter 37, he's laid waste to the northern kingdom. That's gone. And he's set his sights on the southern kingdom and he wants the prize, Jerusalem. And we are told in those passages that he lays siege and destroys all the fortified cities in Judea except Jerusalem. And he's got one left. The last one to fall before Jerusalem is called Lachish, which was a Philistine city, now a Hebrew city, fortified, great walls, a pretty big deal, right? It took him some time to destroy it. Now, this is actual, and his son rebuilt it. Now, this is actual, I'm not making this up. Between 1845 and 1847, a massive archaeological find was discovered in Mosul, Iraq, which is Nineveh, the capital city of the Assyrian Empire, and what was discovered was Sennacherib's palace. It's amazing. And one of the rooms that has been labeled room number 26, archaeologists have agreed unanimously that this is the waiting room to go into Sennacherib's throne room. So if you were going to see Sennacherib, this is where you waited. And the equivalent of reading an old Time or Life magazine on the table was looking at the slabs of these reliefs that were around the wall. Do you know what those slabs depicted? The fall of Lachish. Fantastic archaeological find for biblical history. All right, we got to move fast. Nebuchadnezzar, a.k.a. Nebuchadnezzar I, sacked Nineveh in 612 as prophesied by Nahum and Zephaniah. Assyria was weakened but made an alliance with Egypt. All right, so Nebuchadnezzar, who is Nebuchadnezzar's father, significantly was able to weaken the Assyrian Empire, but they made a last-ditch effort of trying to align themselves with Egypt. You can read about how Jerusalem, the southern kingdom, tried to make alliances with Egypt as well in Jeremiah chapter 2, which is also known as God's writ of divorce against Israel because of all their sins. And he's saying, this time the Babylonians are coming and you're not stopping them. I've given you enough chances. And then we move up to Josiah and Jehoiakim. Josiah, one of the last kings of the southern empire, attempted to break up the Egyptian-Assyrian alliance. He was fatally wounded at the Battle of Megiddo. Is that going to be an important place later on? Yeah, that land has been soaked with blood more than once. And then Pharaoh Necho, who of course invented Necho wafers, installed Jehoiakim on the throne in Jerusalem. You can read about that in 2 Chronicles 36. And so we come up to 605 B.C. And leading up to that, Nebuchadnezzar has a defeat, a sounding defeat of the Assyrians at the Battle of Carchemish. They're done. And while he's out on campaign, he hears that his father has died. So he is now the great king of Babylon. And he does what any great king would do. He stops by one of his new tribute cities, Jerusalem, rings a doorbell, ding dong. You know who I am, do not resist me. I'm here to take captives back with me to enroll in the University of Babylon. Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. Now, just looking at that history, you'd say, well, this is just the way history goes. It's one city beating down another. Or is it? Is there actually something behind that story? Who or what is behind human history? We are rapidly running out of time this morning, so I'm going to sum up quickly three views. Two of them are alternative views. Because again, if I would ask you who or what is behind human history, this is one of those times when one of the three classic Sunday school answers is correct. God, right. Right? So that is correct. I hold to that. Daniel held to that, which allowed him to have a high-profile public witness for God in a hostile environment. Here are the other possibilities. First one is a name that many of you would recognize, Charles Darwin, who lived from 1809 to 1882, who argued in his Origin of the Species that all living things come from common descent. And Darwinian evolution was the fertile soil that took off in the 19th, 20th century and is still with us today, that says that human history is nothing more, here's the alternative, listen to me, is nothing more than biochemical determinism. What does that mean? It means that your matter is all that matters. Survival of the... Well, if that's true, well then, Babylon deserves to win, do they not? Now, did Daniel and his friends have any concept of Charles Darwin? No. But they could have said, well, this is just the way it is supposed to be. By the way, if Darwin's right, there is no explanation for moral responsibility, among other things. And so Daniel and his friends knew that as part of God's story, their story is that they are morally responsible creatures, not only to each other and their fellow man, but to God. Hence, keeping their mouths shut to play it safe was not an option. Second guy, Friedrich Nietzsche, 1844 to 1900. He said that anybody who is a person of faith, that would be me, a lot of you in this room, that would be Daniel and his friends, he would say that anybody who is a person of faith, that word faith belongs in the cave, which is a reference to Plato's allegory of the cave. Friedrich Nietzsche was no fan of the Greek philosopher Plato. In fact, he hated him because he said he systematized thinking, and Nietzsche didn't like that. And he said that anybody who believes in faith, they merely see shadows and experience dust. They don't experience any substance whatsoever. And in several of his writings, he talks about his idea of history, which is an eternal recurrence, or something goes around and around and around. Did you see a pattern in that really quick history of Babylon that I gave to you? Anybody see a pattern? Somebody tell me, what was the pattern that you saw? Yeah, one defeat after another. Somebody builds up the city, somebody tears it down, somebody comes back, over and over and over. That would be a perfect example of what Friedrich Nietzsche would call the eternal recurrence of going around and around and around and around. Because he believed time was infinite, that time was in an infinite loop, and that but particles or stuff, matter, is not. And so it eventually would just reconstitute itself in the same way at some point again in the future. He would also say in books like Beyond Good and Evil or A Genealogy of Morals, he would say that that there are two classes of people. There are wolves and there are sheep. Now, according to Nietzsche, if you're in this room, you're a sheep. And he would have disdain for you. And I tend to think that's a badge of honor that we should wear proudly. But he would say the wolf doesn't need to be told he is a wolf, doesn't need to be affirmed by anyone else, because he or she knows that they are wolves and therefore will do what is necessary to thin out the sheep when they have to. I want you to think about that for a second. If Friedrich Nietzsche is right, the next time that we get the terrible news of a mass shooting at a school, if Friedrich Nietzsche is right, you should have no reason to mourn that. I asked my students in my ethics class, are all these things wrong? And I listed out several of these horrible atrocities that have happened over and over and over again in recent months in our very nation. I said, are these things wrong? Should they happen? And they're just like, why would you even ask with this concerned look on their face? These are horrible, they're reprehensible, they're murderous, they're evil. And my question to them is, why? If there is no God behind human history, what makes it wrong? It might be hard for you to hear, but the answer is nothing. So Daniel and his friends could have said, well, there's nothing but raw power. That's what Nietzsche was getting at. He said, there's just raw power. And the person who's going to live is going to recognize that their life is a continuous loop. There's no escape. They accept their destiny. They put their head down and they go through life. Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah could have done that. Or the last guy, his name is Gottfried Leibniz. I really wish I had time to show you his picture because he's got the sweetest hair in all of philosophy. It's like flowing locks. It's amazing. Gottfried Leibniz was a contemporary of Sir Isaac Newton. They invented calculus at the same time, independently. He's not stupid. We're on his bus, by the way. If you're like agreeing with what I'm saying, then you're on the Leibniz train. Leibniz was a guy who argued for the existence of God using what's called the cosmological argument for the existence of God. Very simply, just asking, why is there something rather than nothing? And it says, well, if God didn't make the something out of nothing, ex nihilo, then it either has always existed in eternity past, which is mathematically and philosophically impossible, by the way, or it popped into existence on its own. Not good evidence for that. So in this conversation, he said, all right, so an explanation for why the universe exists also then begs the question of what does it mean? He said, well, there's a couple possibilities. Either we are told from the outside what it means, i.e. there's a God behind human history, or there would be pantheism, and that would mean that the universe would have the ability to reach out its hand and introduce itself to you. That doesn't happen. Think about it this way. If this room was a universe and you could not get outside of it, nor see outside of it, we were sealed in here, we could spend our lifetimes learning everything we could about this room, could we not? And at the end of our lives, you could die. Is there anything that you would learn that would say, this is a room? Nope. Nothing about the dimensions or anything tells you what it is. You only know it's a room because you've been outside. So he would say that in understanding the purpose of the universe can't tell you what its purpose is. So then he said the other option is that there really is no meaning, or the word he uses is nihilism, which means nothingnessism. This is what the position of Friedrich Nietzsche, who argued consistently, and it's scary for this, he said there's nothing. And he would say, friends, if the universe means nothing because it cannot tell you what it means, or if there really is no value, then your value is purely gratuitous. That means you just assign value to yourself at random and it means nothing. My students are told for years that the universe is chaotic, random, meaningless. Somehow order erupts out of chaos, which is in complete juxtaposition of things like the second law of thermodynamics. It says that's why cold drinks get warm and warm drinks get cold. As we're moving toward the word is entropy, or just heat death, chaos. And my students are told that, and many of you hear that as well, and then they suddenly get to college and say, now, find your purpose. Wait a minute, time out. So anybody with two brain cells to rub together goes, how does that work? Ladies and gentlemen, I want you to stop and consider. Okay, it's an easy question, I realize, for an august group such as yourself. Who or what is behind human history? Well, God is, of course. And why does that matter? And have you ever taken the opportunity to consider the alternatives? You see, Daniel and his friends never, ever, ever could have had the high-profile public witness for God that they demonstrated for us without resting completely in the fact of the God who is there. And because they knew that, they knew that their story meant something. That the great dramatic story arc of history is not aimlessly spiraling off into chaos, but it is moving toward an end. There's a goal. There's going to be redemption. And they knew it. Even though everything had been taken from them, their homes, their lives, they tried to erase their history, as we will look at next time. In fact, they probably had the physical manifestation of their manhood taken from them, made into eunuchs. Everything is gone. Yet they said, I will follow God. Why? Because they believed deep down in his heart that there's this kindly old gentleman that's smiling down upon him. No, because the God of the universe spoke the universe into creation. And nothing escapes his knowledge or plan. And those who rest in the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, the great I Am, who Jesus declares himself to be in John chapter 8, your story, my story, means something. Because it is part of God's story. Ryan, would you come and close us in prayer? Or Josh.